This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents The Secret History of the American Empire by John Perkins. Read by Jonathan Davis. With a special introduction, read by the author. Part 3. The Middle East. Chapter 29. A Bankrupt United States of America. Petroleum distinguished itself as history's all-time most valuable resource during the first half of the 20th century. It became the driving force behind modernization. Procuring reliable supplies formed the cornerstone of foreign policies. Japan's petroleum obsession was a major factor in the decision to attack Pearl Harbor. World War II elevated oil to even higher status. It fueled tanks, airplanes, and ships. A combatant country without oil was doomed. Oil also evolved into the single most powerful tool of the corporatocracy. After peace was declared, U.S. oil company executives formulated a plan that would change the course of history. They decided that it was in their best interests, and therefore the country's, to convince the President and Congress to save U.S. reserves for future wars and other emergencies. Why drain domestic oil fields when those of other continents could be exploited? In collaboration with U.K. and European companies, they persuaded governments to grant them tax breaks and other incentives they claimed were required to ensure domination of global petroleum supplies. This decision, which has been endorsed by every president and Congress since, led to policies that have redefined national borders, created kingdoms, and brought down governments. Like gold, oil turned into a symbol of power and the basis for valuing currencies. Unlike gold, it is essential to modern technologies, to the plastics, chemical, and computer businesses. At first, it appeared that the oil executives' plan would heap wealth on third-world oil-producing countries. However, following in gold's footsteps, oil became an albatross. Petroleum-rich countries were similar to prospectors in the boom towns of the Old West. As soon as they filed claims, they became the targets of scoundrels and robber barons. At roughly the same time that oil was emerging as the key to the modern age, the Soviet Union surfaced as public enemy number one. Historians recognize that empire builders require external threats. The USSR conveniently played this role for the United States. Moscow's nuclear arsenal gave credence to the corporatocracy's claims that the Cold War demanded novel approaches to international diplomacy. It is not surprising that the first real Cold War showdown over oil occurred in that part of the world containing the most oil, the Middle East. Demanding that his people share in petroleum profits from their lands, the democratically elected and highly popular Iranian Prime Minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, Time magazine's Man of the Year in 1951, nationalized a British petroleum company's assets. An outraged England sought the help of her World War II ally, the United States. Both countries feared that military intervention would provoke the Soviets into pulling the nuclear trigger. Instead of the Marines, Washington dispatched CIA agent Kermit Roosevelt Jr., Theodore's grandson. With a few million dollars, Roosevelt organized violent demonstrations that eventually overthrew Mossadegh. The CIA replaced this democratically elected leader with Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the Shah, a despotic friend of big oil. As discussed in my book Confessions, Roosevelt's success generated a whole new profession, the one I followed, that of EHMs. The lessons of Iran were clear. An empire could be built without the risks of war and at far less expense. The CIA's tactics could be applied wherever resources existed that the corporatocracy wanted. There was only one problem. Kermit Roosevelt was a CIA employee. Had he been caught, the consequences would have been dire. The decision was made to replace government operatives with agents from the private sector. One of the companies enlisted was mine, Maine. Very soon, we EHMs discovered that we did not need to wait for countries to nationalize oil fields as an excuse to manipulate their politics. We turned the World Bank, the IMF, and other multinational institutions into colonizing tools. We negotiated lucrative deals for U.S. corporations, established free trade agreements that blatantly served our exporters at the expense of those in the Third World, and burdened other countries with unmanageable debts. In effect, we created surrogate governments that appeared to represent their people, but in reality were our servants. Some of the earliest examples: Iran, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Egypt, and Israel. In tandem with EHM efforts to dominate global politics, the corporatocracy launched campaigns to increase oil consumption. Like drug dealers, public relations experts fanned across the planet, encouraging people to buy goods sold by corporatocracy organizations, often petroleum-based and produced in Third World sweatshops under appalling conditions. During the decades after the Iranian coup, economists frequently cited examples of rapid economic growth as proof that poverty was declining. However, as we saw in Asia, the statistics deceived. In addition to ignoring social and environmental degradation, the statistics failed to address long-term problems. A good example of these unintended consequences is provided by events resulting from Roosevelt's Iranian adventure. The coup may have brought an oil-friendly dictator to power, but it also institutionalized anti-American movements in the Middle East. Iranians never forgave the United States for overthrowing their popular democratically elected prime minister, nor have people in neighboring countries. Scholars of political history wonder what might have happened had Washington supported Mossadegh and encouraged him to apply oil revenues toward helping Iran's people pull themselves out of poverty. Many conclude that this would have encouraged other countries to pursue democratic approaches and might have prevented the terrible violence that has plagued the region ever since. Instead, the United States served notice that it was not a country to be trusted, not the defender of democracy we portrayed ourselves to be, and that our aim was not to help the Third World. We simply wanted to control resources. The United States experienced severe problems at home during the same period. The process of expanding the corporatocracy's power base plunged our nation deep into debt. Increasingly, the factories that produced our products, as well as the oil fields, were located in other countries. Foreign creditors demanded payments in gold. The Nixon administration responded in 1971 by revoking the gold standard. Now Washington was confronted with a new dilemma. If our creditors turned to other currencies, the corporatocracy could be forced to pay their loans off at the value they had held relative to gold when those debts were incurred. This would be calamitous, because corporatocracy coffers no longer contained funds sufficient to buy down the debt. The lone sentinel barring the bankruptcy door was the U.S. Mint, with its capacity to print dollars and dictate their value. It was imperative that the world continue accepting dollars as the standard currency. In the prologue of this book, I summarized the solution as revolving around Saudi Arabia. That is the short version. The longer story includes two other unwitting allies who came to Washington's rescue. Both of them in the Middle East. Chapter 30. King Dollar. What's going to happen to the dollar? Maine President Jake Dauber asked rhetorically, not long after that momentous 1971 decision to abandon the gold standard. In the end, I suspect its value will be determined by oil. I had been invited to join the Daubers for dinner at the Hotel Intercontinental Indonesia, a stopover for them on their way to the Middle East. Nixon's got a pretty smart team in Kissinger, Schultz, and Cheney. Jake squeezed his wife's hand and looked into her eyes. I anticipate the day when you and I'll sit back on our sofa and say we were part of this great adventure. The U.S. is launching a new period in world history, and we've got front row seats. Jake did not live to see the day he had hoped to share with his wife. He died not long after that trip, and was replaced as Maine's president by his protege, Bruno Zambotti. However, his analysis of the dollar's future turned out to be accurate. Nixon's team was not merely smart. It was cunning. Washington's first ally in the struggle to defend the sovereignty of the dollar was Israel. Most people, including the majority of Israelis, believed that Tel Aviv's decision to launch preemptive attacks against Egyptian, Syrian, and Jordanian troops along its borders in what came to be known as the Six-Day War of 1967 was driven by Israel's determination to protect its borders. Territorial expansion was the most obvious outcome. By the end of that bloody week, Israel had quadrupled its land holdings at the expense of people living in East Jerusalem, parts of the West Bank, Egypt's Sinai, and Syria's Golan Heights. However, the Six-Day War served another purpose. Arabs were humiliated and infuriated by the loss of their territories. Much of their anger was aimed at the United States. They knew that Israel could never have succeeded without American financial and political support, as well as the not-so-veiled threat that our troops were standing by in the unlikely event that Israel needed them. Few Arabs understood that Washington had motives that were far more selfish than defending the Jewish homeland, or that the White House would turn Arab anger to its advantage. Nixon's second and wholly unsuspecting ally was the entire Islamic Middle East. In response to the Six-Day War of 1967, Egypt and Syria simultaneously attacked Israel on October 6, 1973, Yom Kippur, the holiest of Jewish holidays. Knowing that strategically he was on shaky ground, Egypt's president Anwar Sadat pressured Saudi Arabia's King Faisal to strike against the United States, and therefore Israel, in a different way, by employing what Sadat referred to as the oil weapon. On October 16, Saudi Arabia and four other Arab states in the Persian Gulf announced a 70% increase in the posted price of oil. Iran, which is Muslim but not Arab, in an act of Islamic solidarity, joined them. During the ensuing days, Arab oil ministers, agreeing that the United States should be punished for its pro-Israel stance, unanimously backed the idea of an oil embargo. It was a classic game of international chess. President Nixon asked Congress for $2.2 billion in aid to Israel on October 19. The next day, led by Saudi Arabia, Arab oil producers imposed a total embargo on oil shipments to the United States. At the time, few people perceived the cunning behind Washington's move or the fact that it was driven by a determination to shore up a weakened dollar. The impact was immense. The selling price of Saudi oil leaped to new records. By January 1, 1974, it had soared to nearly seven times its price 4 years earlier. The media warned that the U.S. economy was on the verge of collapse. Long lines of cars formed at gas stations across the nation, while economists expressed fears of the possibility of another 1929-style depression. Protecting our oil supplies had been a priority. Suddenly, it became an obsession. We know now that the corporatocracy played an active role in driving oil prices to these record highs. Although business and political leaders, including oil executives, feigned outrage, they were the puppet masters pulling the strings. Nixon and his advisors realized that the $2.2 billion aid package to Israel would force the Arabs into taking drastic actions. By supporting Israel, the administration engineered a situation that generated what was the craftiest and most significant EHM deal of the 20th century. The U.S. Treasury Department contacted Maine and other firms with proven records as corporatocracy henchmen. Our assignment was twofold. to formulate a strategy to ensure that OPEC would funnel the billions of dollars we spent on oil back to U.S. companies, and to establish a new oil standard that would replace the former gold standard. We EHMs knew that the key to any such plan was Saudi Arabia. Because it possessed more oil than any other country, it controlled OPEC. The Saudi royal family was corrupt and highly vulnerable. Like other kings in the Middle East, the Sauds understood the politics of colonialism. Royalty had been bestowed on the House of Saud by the British. Details behind the strategy I helped engineer, the Saudi Arabian money laundering affair, SAMA, are provided in Confessions of an Economic Hitman. In summary, as far as the media was concerned, the House of Saud agreed to three important conditions. It would, 1. Invest a large portion of its petrodollars in U.S. government securities. 2. Allow the U.S. Treasury Department to use the trillions of dollars in interest from these securities to hire U.S. corporations to westernize Saudi Arabia. And 3. Maintain the price of oil within limits acceptable to the corporatocracy. For its part, the U.S. government promised to keep the Saud family in power. There was an additional agreement, one that made few headlines but was crucial to the corporatocracy's need to maintain the dollar as the standard global currency. Saudi Arabia committed to trading oil exclusively in U.S. dollars. With a scratch of a pen, the dollar sovereignty was reestablished. Oil replaced gold as the measure of a currency's value. As I mentioned in the prologue, a side benefit, one appreciated only by the most savvy economists, also allowed Washington to continue imposing a hidden tax on every foreign creditor. Because the dollar reigned supreme, we bought their goods and services on credit. By the time they used that credit to purchase oil or something else from our companies, the value of their funds had diminished due to inflation. The difference between these amounts was cash in the pocket for the corporatocracy, a tax without the need for tax collectors. Jack Dauber's prediction that the dollar's value would be determined by oil proved correct. When Tel Aviv and Washington drove the Arab world into a corner, Arabs had little choice but to strike back in the Yom Kippur War and through the OPEC embargo. This propelled the U.S. Treasury Department into action. EHMs were enlisted to forge a deal with Saudi Arabia that wed the dollar to oil. The dollar was crowned king and has reigned supreme ever since. SAMA changed geopolitics. It helped bring down the USSR, established the United States as an unchallenged superpower, and angered Osama bin Laden, the Saudi millionaire who would mastermind 9/11. As I look back at it, I'm amazed by the gall we had in those days. I often think about the role fate plays in our lives, fate and the way we react to it. I personally could never have taken on an assignment as complex as SAMA without the training I had received a few years earlier in Lebanon. Chapter 31. Manipulating Governments. During my first assignment in Indonesia, I showed my bosses that I was willing to create the inflated economic forecast they desired. As a reward, they promoted me to chief economist, even though I held only a BS in business administration and at the time was the company's sole economist, gave me a raise, and sent me to the Middle East. I had already written reports on Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia, but my research had been conducted at libraries and through interviews with people from those countries working for us in Boston. This first trip was a short one to get to know Iran and prepare a more in-depth analysis of its energy sector. Charlie Illingworth, who had been my project manager in Indonesia, suggested that I stop over for a couple of days in Beirut. At that time, the city's reputation as a playground was still intact. It would be, he told me, an ideal place to relax, catch up on the time zone changes, and familiarize myself with Middle Eastern culture. He knew someone at the embassy there who would show me around. Lebanon had enjoyed a golden age following the end of World War II. agriculture and small-scale industry flourished. Beirut developed into a wealthy cosmopolitan city, the center of Middle Eastern banking and trade. As I read about the country prior to my departure date, I was intrigued to find frequent comparisons to both Switzerland and Paris. I was amazed to learn that ski resorts dotted the mountains outside Beirut, a Mediterranean city I had visualized as sitting on the edge of a desert, and that the cabarets and art galleries rivaled those of Paris. I also read about Lebanon's shadow side. It stretched back into history and seemed to turn darker with each passing moment. Tensions between religious factions had smoldered for centuries. The coastal regions were ruled by Maronite Christians. The Druze sect of Islam dominated the southern mountains, while Orthodox Sunnis governed the fertile Bekaa Valley. Most of the Maronites were Syrian, a fact that created additional tensions among Arab Muslims. Despite these specific characteristics, I discovered that Lebanon was a sort of microcosm for the Middle East. Europe had coveted Lebanon since the time of the Crusades. Attempts to colonize it continued through the centuries. Claiming a mandate to protect Christian communities, French troops invaded in the late 1700s. Paris assumed the patronizing role characteristic of imperial powers and dispatched its soldiers several times during the 1800s. In 1926, France formed the Lebanese Republic, which was administered under the French Mandate of Syria. In 1940, the French rulers in Beirut declared allegiance to the Nazi-controlled Vichy government. With France soon occupied by Germany, the Vichy authorities in 1941 allowed Germany to move aircraft and supplies through Syria to Iraq, where they were used against British forces. The United Kingdom, fearing that Nazi Germany would gain full control of Lebanon and Syria by pressuring the weak Vichy government, sent its army into Syria and Lebanon. Nationalistic fervor swept many countries during World War II. Lebanon gained full independence on January 1, 1944. A national covenant accepted by the two most prominent Christian and Muslim leaders, Bishara al-Khoury and Riyad el-Sul, apportioned political power among the nation's various communities. Drawing on the 1932 census that calculated Christians at 54% of the population, it mandated that the president would be a member of the majority, the Maronite Christians, while the less powerful prime minister would come from the Sunni population, and the speaker of the legislature would be Shia. The commander of the army would be a Maronite. Many Arabs, feeling that the 12-year-old census was archaic and that Muslims in fact outnumbered Christians, were outraged at this arrangement that tipped the scales in favor of the Christians in Lebanon and the West in general. Arabs also suspected that newly created Israel was not all that it appeared to be. The only country ever mandated by the UN and a place that Jews called their promised land, Israel was offered as a sanctuary after the horrors of Hitler. The Arabs, like Americans and Europeans, were told that the atrocities committed against the Jews necessitated the creation of such a state. The suffering of the Jewish people, the traumas of their lives under fascism, were indisputable. There could be no question that the world owed them something better. But in order for this to happen, millions of Palestinians were told they had to give up their homes. Turned overnight into refugees, they flooded into Lebanon and every other Middle Eastern country. The Palestinian influx confirmed that the 1932 census was irrelevant. There could be no doubt that Muslims now outnumbered Christians in Lebanon. The realization that the National Covenant was being used as a political weapon was further proof for Muslims that there was a second, more sinister purpose behind the creation of Israel, that it was a servant of empire, an armed outpost for the victors of World War II, designed to control Middle Eastern oil. Lebanon, they suspected, was being groomed to support Israel and its allies. The Christian leadership, established by the National Covenant, was part of a sinister plot. Lebanese Arab resentment erupted into a Muslim rebellion in 1958. U.S. politicians blamed communist terrorists. Washington accused Moscow of fomenting this uprising, although it was backed by Syria more than the USSR. President Eisenhower sent in the Marines. U.S. forces occupied Lebanon for only a brief period, from May until October, but their presence confirmed Arab suspicions that Washington was determined to keep the Christians in power. The U.S. president's willingness to interfere militarily had a profound long-term impact on Muslims throughout the region. Lebanon was also incensed by Washington's aggressive interference in nearby Iraq. During the late 1950s and early 1960s, the popular Iraqi president, Abdul Karim Qasim, grew increasingly defiant toward the United States and the United Kingdom. He demanded that foreign oil companies share the profits they'd reaped from Iraqi oil with his people, and threatened to nationalize them if they did not comply. When EHM efforts failed to bring Qasim around, the CIA hired an assassination team that included a young man who had not yet completed his schooling, Saddam Hussein. The team opened fire on Qasim's car. They riddled it with bullets, but only managed to wound him. Saddam was shot in the leg and fled to Syria. In 1963, President Kennedy made a fateful decision. He ordered the CIA to join MI6, British intelligence, on a mission to accomplish what the assassins had failed to do. They executed Qasim by firing squad on Iraqi television. After that, an estimated 5,000 people were rounded up, accused of communism, and executed. Within a few years, Saddam was brought back and installed as head of national security. His second cousin became president. During this same period, the demographics in Lebanon were changing radically. Muslim populations expanded faster than the Christian. In the late 1960s, they demanded revisions in the National Covenant. However, Maronites refused, continuing to dominate the government. The threat that Washington would send in troops once again to support the Christians was underscored when the United States reinstated the military draft and built up its armed forces around the world. Geopolitics also changed. In the 1967 Six-Day War, Israel seized parts of Jerusalem, Syria, and Egypt. The Arab world was outraged. Support for Palestinian militants grew. The PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization, used refugee camps in southern Lebanon to stage attacks on Israel. By the time I headed for Beirut in 1973, the last semblance of stability was unraveling. Yet, like most Americans who did not speak Arabic and therefore communicated only with or through men educated in American or British schools and whose success depended on our continued presence in their country, I was extremely naive. I could read about the dark history of places like Lebanon. I understood that there were deep-seated antagonisms between Arabs, Christians, and Jews, but I had been trained to believe that capitalism would work miracles. I had recently been promoted. I was flying first class, staying in the best hotels, and dining at the finest restaurants, frequently accompanied by beautiful women. Along with all the other U.S. businessmen, consultants, and government officials, and the experts at the World Bank and the IMF, I was confident that we were making great strides toward democracy and progress throughout the Middle East. Lebanon would open my eyes to a different reality.